Okay, hello, it's Paul Bowman again, and today in the conversation I'm having to keep me sane during lockdown is with Dr. Darren Kelsey. Now, Darren is head of media, culture and heritage at Newcastle University in the UK. And in terms of, hi Darren, you all right? In terms of, I'll stop sharing that. In terms of martial arts studies, he appeared on our radar when he published this article in the journal Martial Arts Studies called Effective Mythology and the Notorious Conor McGregor, Monomyth, Mysticism and Mixed Martial Arts. So before that, as far as I'm aware, you, Darren, hadn't really written directly about martial arts. Is that, was this the first thing that you wrote?
Yeah, this was the first thing I wrote on martial arts. And because my work beforehand had been focused on mythology, archetypal storytelling and mythology in media and popular culture. So I did that piece really because I was interested. I wasn't talking so much about martial arts on a technical level, but actually stories of martial arts, and particularly the story of Conor McGregor. Looking at McGregor's mythos, so to speak, and I was just interested in the way in which he kind of transcended the sport and had this popular appeal beyond the UFC. And I wanted to just look at the kind of storytelling that had gone on around him and how he told his own story as well in a way that had all these different interesting kind of cultural mythologies within the stories around him. So that was the main focus for that piece.
So you are looking at the list of publications. I mean, you publish in all different sorts of areas, from journalism to popular culture to media to remembering the ways that we remember the Second World War and all sorts of things. Is your interest defined by the question of what is it that makes something transcend something? So like, what is it that makes Conor McGregor bigger than MMA in a way? Is
Yeah,
that
I'm really interested in how we tell stories as societies, and also this oscillation between individual and the collective. So how storytelling works in our own kind of personal lives, domestic lives, professional lives, but then on a much broader scale, how we tell stories as nations and civilizations about ourselves and each other and so on. So going back to my earlier research, I'd looked at the myth of the Blitz, which never seems to go away in the topical relevance of it. We're seeing it again at the moment, but that research I did on the myth of the Blitz was much more about the Second World War in relation to the July 7th bombings, how discourses of the Second World War and the myth of the Blitz spirit was used by the press and politicians and the public as well after the July 7th bombings to try and kind of make sense of what had happened and what it meant and where we were going and the crisis we faced and so on. And it was a critical analysis of the problems with that, both historically, how we have a very simple story of or a kind of popular memory of how Britain responded to the Blitz, which historically has been looked at as a myth in itself, not as a lie, because it's not all untrue, but it's a very simple story that leaves out a lot of inconvenient details that don't fit the popular narrative. But also, I was interested in how that historical myth gets lifted and reused in modern or contemporary contexts, and the July 7th bombings was one of them. But even at the moment, with the coronavirus, we're seeing these tensions break out in the different ways that this myth's used. So the same myth often gets used for completely different or oppositional political purposes. It's particularly interesting at the moment because the idea of business as usual, as one of the popular slogans, doesn't really work. And people have tried to use it, and then other people are saying, well, no, it's not business as usual. That won't be okay. You can't just keep calm, carry on. But yeah. I could talk about that all day.
And you're well, let's I'm trying not to talk about coronavirus too much.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find a way to think about things that that kind of used to seem important. And I know that one of the things that just before the pandemic became a pandemic, we were both talking a lot about researching Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and we were planning to co-author something, which we still probably will do, but it's really hard to work out a way to reconfigure what we were thinking about, because we were both interested, I think, in the way that there seems to be something special about Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and you were very interested in looking at the stories that are being told about it. I mean, could you tell us a little bit more about your interest in the stories being told about Brazilian jiu-jitsu?
Yeah, so I was interested in the way in which Brazilian jiu-jitsu was being talked about for treatment for anxiety, and I was interested in the parallels between cognitive behavioural therapy and stoicism, which I was reading a lot about, and the way in which people talk about Brazilian jiu-jitsu being used as a kind of as a therapy that parallels those principles. So things like not trying to control things beyond your control, leave your ego at the door. Obviously, if you take your ego on the mat as a beginner in jiu-jitsu, you're in trouble. What else was there? Getting used to being in uncomfortable positions, concentrating on your breathing, being in the moment now and not worrying about the future. There were so many parallels that between these kind of principles of CBT, and that, for people who don't know, the foundations of cognitive behavioral therapy, a lot of them are based on Stoic philosophy. And so, and I've been reading, writing a lot about Stoic philosophy since I started CBT myself. And I got really interested in that. And so the storytelling around Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and the way in which a lot of celebrities are talking about it as well, and talking about it in terms of these things that I just mentioned in a moment ago, I found really interesting, and was, as I started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu fairly recently, I really wanted to just see how much of this really worked in practice. And I found it amazing how trying to apply those principles in the context of training really did work, and how much better I felt as well after training, and the extra layer of discipline that it brought to applying those principles of CBT. So I found that when I started CBT soon after I started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu to kind of test these principles out, and then life got in the way a little bit, and I stopped. And as I let my discipline slip, and I wasn't quite looking after my mental health in the way that I'd kind of made loads of progress with, I went back and started to retune myself again, get refocused. And that's when I went back to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu again and thought, I'm going to stick at it this time.
Yeah.
And rejoined it quite recently. And that was when we got talking about it again and working on this stuff, which has been rudely interrupted by Corona.
Yeah, we have certain similarities in the sense that I started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I had some life issues. I was tired of the martial arts I was doing. I had family issues that meant I was missing training a lot. And I found some jiu-jitsu classes that were really convenient in terms of time. So like I could focus on the family stuff that I needed to focus on. And I guess I was, funnily enough, I'd been diagnosed with anxiety and signs of depression because of some family reasons. And I started CBT and I just rejected it. I was not.
Really?
Because for me, I'm looking at it going, yeah, but I'm fine. I'm depressed because someone else in my life is really depressed. Mm-hmm. And other people in my life have problems. That is dragging me down. And I don't think the problem lies within me. And I'm a relentlessly optimistic person anyway. But I started the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu classes at lunchtime. And it completely revitalized me, like in terms of my energy for family life. it also in terms of my academic interests as well. It's like, to me, when we started talking about this, I felt like I was in the middle of some grand perspective worldview shift that was all enabled by the radical difference of Brazilian jiu-jitsu to everything I'd ever done before. I mean, it's like, you know, D.S. Farah has written an article recently called Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is Therapy. And I don't think he touches on precisely what it's therapy for, but like a lot of people think that it is really transformative. So you think that for you, it's like a kind of CBT in practice or in an embodied way?
Yeah. I mean, Sam Harris wrote an interesting piece called The Pleasure of Drowning, and talked about the kind of things we're discussing now, but also the way in which Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is different to other martial arts too, and the way that it can be practiced to its, it can be fully practiced with fairly minimal risk. So yes, you can practice other martial arts and striking techniques, but being repeatedly punched in the head, whatever, you know, it has a risk level to it that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu doesn't have. So there's something to be said for that, the intensity of it, that you can, and I'm not talking now someone who's pretending to suddenly be an expert on Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I don't want to sound like one of those people who comes in and does it for 5 minutes and pretends they know it all. I'm talking as a person that is just a white belt, just starting out, who's done martial arts before but never done Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, or not done it for very long. So, but I do think that level of intensity, that providing you have the right mindset and the right discipline, and you think rather than every time you're tapping out, you're thinking I've lost again. You see it as a constant learning. That's a different mindset, especially when you haven't got the added layer of, you know, risk and being smacked in the face, which helps. Yeah.
I found that one interest, because I'm used to grappling a bit. I've done some judo, we've done some grappling and rolling about and things in different martial arts that I've done, but nothing quite like the intensity of, like, I'm like about 13 stone or something. I'm not very heavy, right? And when you've got some 15 stone, 16 stone, 6 foot bloke on top of you, crushing the life out of you, it makes you face yourself. Because when do you tap? You know, I don't mind if a choke comes on, I'll tap, like, I'll admit, yeah. But there's not the fear, there's just the definitive, oh. But when someone really heavy is crushing the wind out of you, or they're inching their entire body weight up you, so, like, horrible things, like their groin is facing your face and stuff, and you can't breathe. I realized that I suffer from claustrophobia. It induced panic in me. And so when I'd be in that situation and I can breathe, but I'm being smothered against someone's t-shirt or body or gi, it puts you in touch with, you have to learn your own fears. And you're like, Jesus Christ, I never knew I was claustrophobic, but I'm like, it induced panic in me. So then the next time you go back and you go, ah, this is a bad situation. I really want to protect my airway as much as possible. But even if I lose it, when do I panic? When do I lose my shit and tap? When do I give up?
Yeah. The point you briefly mentioned at the beginning about judo is interesting, because I did judo a lot as a kid and I absolutely loved it and I was really good at it. And then I went to go back to it as an adult, and I went back to it when I was 16 stone. And before I even started thinking about how I thought and the stories in my own head and all the stuff that I've addressed recently. And it just didn't work at all. Like I could not get through a class without an injury. I bust my ribs twice within 3 months. So that was just a disaster. I really wanted to get back into martial arts, and it was quite sort of depressing. Like I just thought, oh, well, there's no option now, I won't bother. And Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is, whilst it is, it's intense and it has a physical, it can take its toll on the body in its own way. I don't find it to have that same, I don't know if it, I think you mentioned before that judo as well, it doesn't have that same kind of crippling, oh, now I'm out for another 6 weeks after one class, sort of.
Well, I turned to judo too late in life, and I would go for one class, and that was me literally. Even if I wasn't injured, it would take the 7 days. By the next class, a week later, I was like, I'm still not better.
Yeah.
I'm still smashed to pieces. But yeah, I mean, let's talk about the kind of stories that people tell about then, because I know that you, when we first discussed this, you drew my attention to the way that people like Russell Brand talk about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu what do you think about, so I think Russell Brand has really tried to express on his, like, he's got a vlog, hasn't he? So he would regularly update whenever he got a stripe on his belt stuff. And he was trying to find a vocabulary for articulating what was so astonishing to him about and what was so transformative. And I think that he did a really good job of expressing something quite clearly that's quite unique, much better than many other people, even because there's quite a lot of celebrities and public figures who have started jiu-jitsu and some who are really exceptional at it. But I mean, what do you think about those types of stories and what Russell Brand has said and other celebrities have said about it?
Yeah, I think that's, Russell Brand's a really interesting case because he's kind of used his experience, again, as a white belt and somebody just starting out, to the things that he's, the values of the sport and the training and the traditions are things that he's kind of tried to focus on as parallels for those values that he's talking about more broadly. So, you know, thinking about the collective psychology and thinking about, you know, oneness and community and all of these kinds of things. And he's tried to use the kind of rituals and traditions of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu training, to parallel his own kind of social commentary that he provides when he talks about how he feels that we, you know, should live as a society and behave towards each other. He's talked about the way in which on the mat you have these kind of hierarchical rituals of lining up in terms of expertise and experience, but a respect for anybody of any level, and suddenly all the cultural baggage that you carry around with you in terms of identity and background, all these things suddenly don't mean anything on the mat. So he tried to talk about those things in a way that I think are quite useful and constructive and helpful. And I personally have found that joining a club or joining an academy, I have experienced the kind of community and togetherness and friendliness that people talk about in the stories of jiu-jitsu that I was hearing a lot of before I started it as well. So I don't want to sound naive, like it's some utopian thing across the entire sport and you never get a, I was going to say arsehole, or just have, but you know, I'm not pretending it's utopia or simplifying it, but there definitely are those positive values in the sport, definitely.
Yeah, I think it is, when you're in a lesson, there can be no bullshit. There's only the truth of what you can and can't do and what you can and can't sustain. It instates and then it subverts hierarchies, because you're looking at the belts and you're going, okay, blue, okay, brown, okay, right, okay. And you know what you're dealing with, and everyone can recognize each other in a hierarchy, kind of. But then there is lining up in lines, which is traditional across martial arts according to rank. But then there's the insistence on the handshakes, and after the class everyone shakes everyone's hands, and it's like, you know, there's a real sense of unity and honesty and kind of camaraderie. And also I think it does interesting things with gender spaces, because you do make friends in other practices. You do make friends down the pub, you make friends when you punch and kick when you spar with each other. But you don't have the kind of intensity of either triumphing or surviving a near-death experience, because, you know, if you're sparring and you get hit three times, bang, 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 and you might be down, then you get up again, you might shake hands, pat each other on the back. But if you're so intimate that you've just been choked out and then you tap, and then it seems to produce a kind of shared elation or a shared bond that is different to things that are more distanced. Mm. And men tend to be quite distanced anyway. So you immediately go back to something childlike. You're playing, you're wrestling, you're fun fighting with another man. I'm saying man. I haven't rolled with many women. I don't understand the politics of that yet. But I mean, the negotiation of those, of that physicality and issues around intimacy seems quite intense and not really talked about all that much, even in the academic literature. There is some work on physical borders and gender and so on. But I mean, do you think that's a significant part of it?
Well, one thing that stood out then, before I started, one thing I thought before I started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was people would talk about how it was a sport where, you know, it's all about technique, or mostly about technique, to the point where the smaller, physically weaker person can take down and take on and submit the stronger person.
Yeah.
And I went into it thinking, I'm not, is this one of these exaggerated kind of myths of the sport? And when I very, the first club that I went to, when I first briefly tried it, I remember in one of my first classes watching, there was a woman there who was a blue belt and was tiny, and they were doing King of the Mat, and she was fighting off her back and was sweeping these massive blokes to the ground and submitting them really quickly. And I remember seeing that and thinking, blimey, that's the level of, I think, Jocko Willink, when he talks about first learning jiu-jitsu, he was talking about how he felt that other blokes had this, who were using it against him, even when he was a bigger bloke, had a superpower.
Yeah.
And it was like that. And I was struck by how much I was like, this really is about like technique, and there is a truth to this thing that I thought was probably exaggerated, but clearly isn't.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said about that. I think I saw a bit of a Joe Rogan thing once, and either him or one of his guests saying it is the only martial art that actually delivers on the promise of the smaller and weaker being able to defeat the bigger and stronger.
Yeah.
But and you used the word superpower, and this is my someone that I know who is now Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He said, once you master the basics, then you'll be really impressive a fighter compared to people who don't know the basics. And once you get past that, it's just like a superpower. So what is your, what will your argument be then? Because I know that you're writing books about self-help and kind of therapy culture and stuff. And in essence, without complicating it too much, what will be the main thrust of your argument about the status of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in relation to therapy or self-help?
One thing I'm interested in is the kind of anti-self-help movement, so to speak. So this pushback against all the kind of the positive thinking. If you think positively and you set goals, then either think positively and great things will happen around you, and you're kind of like magnetized good fortune. And it's there's that one thing in the Conor McGregor article is the secret that I talk about, which is a metaphor in his story. But there's also the thing about constant sort of self-improvement and goal setting and so on. And in the self-help literature, there's a pushback against that now, where people are talking about actually accepting that life is about an element of suffering, and talking about things like stoicism is becoming increasingly popular. These kinds of ideas, I think, work. And the reason I think Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu gets talked about as a therapy is because it chimes more with this kind of the ancient philosophy of figures like the Stoics, who talked about don't try the dichotomy of control. Don't try and control the things that you can't. The only thing that is in control are your thoughts and your actions, and you don't allow your ego to control those things and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
I think that the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is being talked about as therapy because it really parallels those philosophical schools of thought. That's what I'd say.
Okay, I mean, do you think that it's So you connect it with Stoicism. I mean, Stoicism's kind of like fashionable in popular psychology and popular self-help at the minute. Is why does that float onto the landscape recently? I mean, what is there something inherent to Stoicism, or is this its moment, you know, or what do you think about that?
I think it's partly because CBT has become quite popular as well. And I think that the endless treadmill of goal setting and positive thinking and trying to do that next thing, that endless pursuit of happiness. We've talked a lot as a consumer society. I think we've fallen into the trap, as Darren Brown would say, of talking about happiness as a noun, a thing that we can get. And actually it's not a thing that it's happiness is a verb. It's something that we do, and we do it through things that give us meaning, things that give us purpose, things that aren't constantly reactive, things that aren't constantly chasing that next thing. It's the verb of, it's a now, it's the moment. Yeah. And I think the Stoics really, as much literature, for all of the literature there is on Stoicism, that the core principles are really quite an obvious nudge. You sometimes just need a nudge. It's not some kind of mind-blowing philosophical breakthrough that you suddenly things will make sense. It's actually just a nudge that that we need to remind us. I think we're getting it a little bit at the moment. As awful as the current situation is, we're suddenly nudged into what really matters most. Then we've pressed the pause button on so much of the noise that we're surrounded by on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. It's suddenly we're forced to confront what really matters. Suddenly you're very, very grateful for the sunshine and having if you're lucky enough to have a back garden, you've got a back garden and nature and family and community and the way in which we are having to look out for each other as a community, this kind of almost belligerent kind of keep yourself to yourself, get down, do what you need to do as an individual, and if you're tough enough and strong enough, you'll get through.
Yeah.
The mask has slipped in that sense.
I think that's why I almost like rejected CBT, because I found it, well, it was connected with a sort of mindfulness, not an embodied mindfulness, but it was connected with a sense of like, have you noticed how lovely it is outside? And I'm like, yes, I've noticed how lovely it is outside. That's what I notice. I mean, like, you know, I do Tai Chi, I do Qigong, I often do yoga poses, and I'm the kind of person who can be delighted for the entire day because I stretched a little bit further without trying, or because I did a beautiful crescent kick, or, you know, like, and I mean, there's an interest, the way these things kind of dovetail. So the way in which therapies like Tai Chi and Qigong have kind of gradually move towards the mainstream, not because they are alternative anymore, but because they link up with principles like those of CBT. So, for example, there's a researcher, doctor, a medical doctor, researcher called Giles Yates, who's done a lot of research on using things like Tai Chi and Qigong therapeutically on stroke victims. Because, you know, if you're a man, if you're in your 60s or 70s, and you're a working class man, and you've had a stroke, and you can't do things anymore, you're not necessarily going to want to talk to a counsellor and say, I feel really bad because I can't use a knife and fork anymore, right? But if you're trying to learn a Tai Chi form, and you're like, then you can start to talk about it in a more kind of like, oh, it's frustrating because ever since the stroke, this, and also to reconnect mind and body physically, so you might learn how to do the move. But also, in that embodied mindfulness work, it's bringing it into vocalization, into bringing it into consciousness as a concept that you can then talk about, which is very similar to CBT, isn't it? So these things kind of dovetail, not in a kind of war of paradigms, but in a kind of complementarity that you wouldn't have expected from something as non-mystical as CBT and something very mystical as Tai Chi or Qigong.
Yeah, I mean, for me, one of the, like a tiniest tweak So one of my problems was always, years of thinking this way, losing things or not being able to be grateful for things I had because I was so paranoid and anxious about losing them. So whether it was waiting to go to university in my gap year and being convinced the letter was going to come through and say it's all a big mistake, you're not coming, or I've got, you know, the lovely wife, lovely kid, lovely house, this is all too good to be true, what's going to happen for me to lose it? And then what the Stoics did was something called negative visualization. It's not impossible for you to lose the things you really appreciate tomorrow.
Yeah.
Therefore, appreciate them now. So I didn't have to just wave a magic wand and make all these negative thoughts go away. It was just a matter of retuning and saying, well, yeah, appreciate them now then, because it's possible you might lose things. So be grateful while you've got them. Yeah. That's so simple. I always feel like an idiot talking about it because it's so simple, but it was, for me, it was just a little retuning in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So your ongoing work then, I mean, the martial arts plays. So I think you're someone who's just going to keep popping back up on the kind of martial arts publication radar with a new sort of statement. But actually, this is just going to be one instance of your larger project, which is thinking about affective mythology, storytelling, maybe self-help for the next couple of years or something like that. The first article was about Conor McGregor and that media persona and the sporting persona and everything. Did this arise because you're a fan of the UFC, or what led to that?
Mainly because I'd always watched the UFC a little bit, and I'd kind of drifted in and out of it on and off throughout the years. And then the whole McGregor thing fascinated me and got me hooked into watching it much, much more. Right. And I was also a big fan of the Joe Rogan podcast. So
yeah,
I was literally listening to people talk about UFC all the time and talking about Conor McGregor a lot. And I was just interested in how so many other things that I talked about in my research around cultural mythology, national identity, that was all, I could see it all there, whether it was the archetypes and the Jungian psychology of storytelling, all those things around national identity and so on. But it was all there in the McGregor story, and I just thought, this is fascinating. It was that when he got the fight with Floyd Mayweather, the outcome of the fight wasn't really the big thing for me. The big story for me was the fact it was happening and he'd somehow managed to make this happen.
Yeah.
Because when it was first talked about, I was like, it's ridiculous. Like, it's not going to happen. And suddenly it did.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought, what is the story around this? And what's it saying?
Yeah.
Also, the point you've previously made about when you talked about Bruce Lee, when you said people get too hung up about, was he a brilliant fighter or was he not? Or, you know, was he the best or was he a fraud or whatever?
Yeah.
And I was similar with him. Sometimes I'll get like a random message on Twitter saying, someone's obviously read this piece and thought I'm just sort of writing this little fanboy. Yeah. And that's really not the point. I'll get a message saying, he's a this, that, and the other, and he's one-dimensional, he got found out, and whatever else. And I'm like, for me, it's not about whether he's the best fighter ever or not. It's about the story of what he reflects and embodies beyond that, beyond just a fighter. And obviously, since that piece that I wrote, his story's changed significantly. So he had that dreadful period of complete chaos. And since then, what's interesting is the way, and I think for a lot of fans as well, what happened with the Amanda Khabib fight crossed a lot of lines, and it wasn't the entertaining story people loved.
Yeah.
What's happened more recently, he's talked about his coaching with Tony Robbins. He started to talk about things, about the fact that he was thinking in the wrong ways and he was preoccupied with material kind of wealth, and he was very invested in other people's opinions of him. And getting very angry about what other people thought or what other people said. And now he's, since the talking about his coaching with Robbins and since the Cowboy fight, it's interesting how he shifted his persona, much more reserved, much more respectful, talking about not becoming invested in things beyond his control. And you can see a bit of that stuff in there. It's probably a bit of confirmation bias on my point because I'm just looking for things. But it seems to me evident in what he's saying that there's been a significant shift in his own mindset.
Yeah. I mean, that the article that you wrote was quite polarizing. People either loved that article or they really, I'm not going to say hated it, but the opposite, but they were like, hang on a minute, this isn't much. I was interested in it because you seemed to be quite, what was radical about it was not what you were saying or arguing about Conor McGregor to me, but it was where you were drawing your academic sources from and your kind of your academic stimulation from. You know, you're writing a lot about Jung and you're using Campbell and using lots of stuff, and you were combining things from different intellectual traditions in a way that I think people talk about doing a lot but then don't do. People talk about like interdisciplinary stimulation and cross-disciplinary discussion stuff, but you seem to be quite happy to do that. Is there a principle for the sources that you draw on? I mean, do you just really love Jung or like, you know, what's your selection bias there? What's your methodological principle behind the choice or whatever?
So I'd always been interested in mythological storytelling from like the semiotic perspective, and then more so from looking at archetypes as well. And then from looking at archetypes became interested in psychology and the work of Jung and the way in which Jung can be kind of carefully read and refined and reused in a modern, in a contemporary context. That was kind of part of a motivation for using and applying Jung, because I felt, and I've done this in other work as well, I think there's some really fascinating ideas that Jung has that can be applied to both our psychology individually and collectively. So that was why I was drawing on that. And I was trying to tread some careful lines between, quite often when people talk about Jung, they immediately jump into the idea that he was too much about nature and not enough about culture. It would often become a nurture nature debate. And I was more recently, I've written a piece about narrative for the Critical Discourse Studies Journal.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to talk there about getting away from this idea of this binary nurture nature thing. This, especially with the ongoing arguments about culture and biology as these. Is it one or the other? Is it more of one or the other? And it's not the debate to be having. It's what we should be looking at is the way in which both are relevant. And if you start to talk about making a case for nature or biology, you're not excusing things that are wrong in the world. I've been arguing in this piece I've just got coming out in Critical Discourse Studies that we need to, whether we use Jung or whether we talk about biology or if we talk about nurture nature, we should always be thinking about ideology.
Yeah.
And if we as long as we maintain in critical studies a focus on ideology, we don't need to be scared of biology. We don't need to be scared of, nature.
Yeah.
Because we can always come back to the idea that even if there is a more natural explanation for things.
Yeah.
We have the ability to, through culture, see what's wrong about the way we live, or see what's unfair and unjust, and we can tackle them.
I mean, I think that's really interesting and important. I think that because within and around martial arts studies, even the scholarship, even some quite respectable kind of places around biology and sociobiology and evolutionary biology and so on, there's quite a lot of talk about essential nature and essential masculinity and this kind of stuff, which is often just complete rubbish based on discredited research into wolves carried out in the 1970s and all this kind of stuff. But I think that it's really important to note that yes, there are our bodies and there is fighting, right? But like fighting is cultural. The way that we fight is cultural. The way that we think fighting is natural is cultural. And there are deep ideologies within it. So what do you think about it? Would you say there is one ideology around Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? Because there's definitely not one ideology around martial arts. However we circumscribe or define martial arts, there is not one ideology. But is there a dominant or hegemonic ideology around Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, do you think?
I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to have an answer to that. I think if we were to look further in that question, it would be multiple fragmentations of ideologies in different, whether it's different countries or different ways in which different people approach the sport. I think I would lean towards, that would be my hunch, but I don't know.
Okay, because the one thing that we once briefly kind of discussed, we briefly mentioned it, we didn't know whether it was an avenue to pursue for the article that we're talking about writing together, was the fact that the Gracie family, they got very invested in certain kinds of spiritualism and vegetarianism, and there is like the Gracie diet, and there's also a Gracie lifestyle, which... maybe that's receded and maybe that's waned somewhat, because nowadays if you watch like Gracie Breakdown and you got those two Californian dudes talking about stuff, they are much more aligned with a kind of pacifistic sporting police related, you know, like the Gracie family's always had a long connection with police forces in Brazil and in America. So where am I going with that? I'm kind of thinking like, Is there an organic moving, shifting, changing ideology? Because I don't know how many people who are Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu experts now are vegetarians, eating an avocado-based diet, and not drinking, or you know, is that?
Have you seen the tension or conflict between one of the Gracies and Eddie Bravo?
No.
That very much comes back to the tension you're talking about there, of this kind of, there isn't one fixed way, and there are definitely shifts away from what we commonly associate with the traditional kind of Gracie approach to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And he, I think he's saying it's not about the, his issue. I'm happy to be corrected if I've recalled this wrong, but whichever member of the Gracie family I was listening to a little while back, he was saying his issue with Eddie Bravo isn't to do with fighting, it's to do with values, and I think to do with cannabis and drinking, and how Hayes openly talks about these things and gives certain terms to certain moves that he comes up with in style of jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And he thinks that some of the language and the styles that Eddie Bravo comes up with reflect values that he doesn't want to be associated with a sport that he wouldn't pass on to his kids and so on. So that's an interesting example of those different cultural shifts within the sport.
Yeah, but I think what interests me is it's always interested me, is the question of whether there can be what you might call an organic or spontaneous ideology. So this is like the old kind of Marxist term for a belief system or a set of values that emerge spontaneously within a given historical or cultural situation. Because I think that you get a lot of blah, blah, blah in martial arts going, these are our values and blah, 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 but they're not materially reflected in the practice. Like there might be some kind of, you know, so the values that might be spontaneous in and around Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu involve one relationships with one's own body and other bodies, and also certain maybe kind of psychological dispositions, rather than you shouldn't smoke weed or you shouldn't drink beer, right? Or you should eat avocados. That to me, that's not the level of ideology that interests me. For me, the level of ideology is to do with the way in which we are embodied, and the way in which that embodiment, that like a practice produces a mode of embodiment, and a relationship to one's own body and to other bodies, and to the way that we will talk and move and interact with people. You know, like, so in a sense, like, maybe Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu kind of reduces social, physical frigidity. So it's not like sexual, although the early jokes about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu were like, wow, doesn't it look really gay? Doesn't it look like gay men having sex, right? That kind of early homophobic response to grappling and ground fighting. But a kind of a freeing of the body from certain other constraints of like heteronormativity and homosociality, to throw in some academic words to make it sound like I'm cleverer than I am. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think there is definitely this... There's definitely, regardless of all those other things that I was talking about a minute ago, the differences that between values and so on, there is certainly the idea of development, not through... Tell me if you think this, if you see it differently. Is, yes, okay, you've got competition, you've got Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in a competitive sense, and people compete in competition, but in terms of the value of it going into a gym and training, it's this idea of development, of continually learning and developing together rather than in conflict with or opposition to, you know, trying to constantly beat an opponent. It's the idea that both people, regardless of hierarchy or tapping out or whatever, are constantly developing each other through the rolling and the grappling. That's certainly something that I feel doesn't go away. It's there regardless of the context.
Okay. Yeah, I think so. I mean, could you... So just to finish off, I realise we've been... I know you're a very busy person. You're in the midst of a certain kind of crisis management and trying to make sure that students at your university are being looked after adequately, and that staff can work. And, you know, this is the burden of the head of school, head of department. So I won't keep you any longer. But do you want to tell us a little bit about your plans for future publication for the work that involves Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or martial arts generally?
Yeah, that's been water, by the way.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. I thought I'm going
to knock down vodka.
Pint of vodka, please. Yeah.
Well, there's a piece we're working on.
Yep.
So
this is neat gin, by the way.
Yeah. That's good. Good move. The piece we're working on, which, to be honest, in terms of publications, at the moment, the notes that I'm taking on experiences of doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and training and so on, they're really a parallel to anything where I'm writing about self-help, self-development, cognitive behavior therapy, stoicism. Whilst I'm sure there will be other articles and along the way, regardless of whether I'm writing about directly about martial arts or not, this is actually a toolkit that I'm using all the time. So I'm seeing it much more in that way. It's something that I'm drawing on when I try to think about how these principles work in practice and how disciplined I'm being in applying the kind of principles of stoicism. And I'm not trying to say I identify as a stoic or anything like that, but it's just toolkits that I'm finding useful. And just trying to give up my interest in storytelling as well. This is the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is just one part of those toolkits that I'm drawing on at the moment to think about these things. So that's
okay.
A bit of a flaky answer, but at least we've got our article that we're working on. So yes, there is that.
Yeah, it's going to be, it's hard to, it's a worry, isn't it? Because when we started to work on that, you know, they were talking about this new virus in China, and it's going to, you know, it's not going to get here and blah, blah, blah. And then now it's a question of thinking about the relationship between martial arts and health and society. We just don't know what's going to happen? I mean, you know, after this, like, what are the social rules that will determine training, who you can train with, and what the risks are? I mean, I still can't accept that I am in danger of death if I get COVID-19. But what I can get is that if I do that training and then I want to go and visit elderly relatives, like, do I have to not train for 2 weeks? Or like or if I go training, I come back home, I might pass this on to my asthmatic wife, or it's gonna, because it throws up a lot of ethical questions about, like, I could just go, oh, sod it, I don't, you know, I want to train, I like training, and that's that. But actually, if we think about it in terms of responsibility, if it could be a cold, or it could be a bit of a sore throat, or it could kill you, are we going to go back to jiu-jitsu after this? And under what conditions?
Yeah, you know? That's really, really difficult. I think it's hard to know what things are going to look like once
the
new normal arrives. But yeah, I think a lot of us haven't quite comprehended how much of an impact this is going to have. If they find that if there's a vaccine, then obviously it all changes. But if there's not, and there isn't one for a long time, yeah, I don't think people have quite realised. We're all talking about whether the Premier League will be back on in 3 weeks or something. We're not actually thinking about these really intimate kind of aspects of our lives, that.
Yeah.
That are going to be impacted upon. Either way, when we do go back to normal, I hope people carry on smiling to each other and saying hello in the street, because that's quite nice.
we could talk about all the bigger worrying things, but I think we'll leave it on the let's hope people just say hello and good morning and it's quite nice. And okay, Dr. Darren Kelsey from Newcastle University, thank you very much. That was really
Thank you very much. Thank you.